Well, we started today, yesterday. So, in yesterday morning, I tried to explain to you that the stable envelopes for the action, so this maps in the equivariance cohomology from the fixed locus to the entire space, and well, that they were realized as certain supersymmetric interfaces between mass, between large mass, where so it goes to sort of infinity in the chamber C, and zero, and I'm talking about real mass, zero real mass on the right. And the idea that that was the realization of this, of course, and then you can also do the same thing for the phi parameters, and that would correspond to the this other stable envelope that Andre used this morning, where you extend from the stable locus to the entire stack. Well, I didn't believe so, but then Andre actually convinced me that that is indeed the true, indeed true. And there was also this another important remark that I forgot to make yesterday, but Andre made it today, that if you switch off the equivariant parameter for the H-bar symmetry, then in this story everything becomes sort of trivial, because the at H-bar equals zero, the theory admits a deformation where all the gradient trajectories, they you can sort of rotate them in such a way that they will all go away to infinity, and there will be no flows connecting different points. And because of the presence of such a deformation, the story becomes sort of trivial when H bar is zero. Now, yesterday in the problem session, I attempted also to start generalizing to three dimensions. So let me continue along that route. So let is if X is our target for the three-dimensional theory, and for us this is really 3D n equals 2, which is secretly 3D n equals 4 broken down to n equals 2 by this H bar equivariant parameter. But really the story, the highest generality in which the story works, is actually 3D n equals 1. And so we have target X, and then we view it as a supersymmetric quantum mechanics into this infinite dimensional space of sort of maps from our elliptic curve to X. And the supercharge that this equivariant supercharge that I was considering in quantum mechanics, it lifts to the one that it, if you square the supercharge, you get the anti-holomorphic translation along the elliptic curve. Now, in the n equals 2 case, this supercharge is actually a sum of two other supercharges, where this is the one used in the holomorphic topological twist. But this story works actually, the construction works more generally, and this is just one of the 3D n equals 1 supercharges. But again, even for the most generic n equals 2 theory, there might be a lot of different issues, and the sort of the case where everything works most nicely is n equals 4 broken down to n equals 2 by the H-bar deformation. So we have this theory on the elliptic curve across time. in the Hilbert space, on the elliptic curve, there's a certain space of supersymmetric ground states. Let me call it V. And we also switch on connections, flat connections, well, on the elliptic curve, which will play a role of the equivariant parameters. So I will denote them by, well, so there are two cycles on there. So one will be denoted A1. Well, if there are many of them, let me also add index I. So let's say this is the A cycle of, and and there's also B, along the B cycle of, and this is the background gauge field. So this connection for the flavored symmetry. More specifically, so we have, of course, some flavor symmetry group here, and we just pick the maximal torus, and then we study slightly bigger torus, which is this A cross U1 H bar. And so this is the flat connection for this torus. And we may also pick complex coordinate, which will be A1. We can choose a complex structure like this. So these variables, are defined mod such shifts, and they parameterize the space, which I will call ET, the space of flat connections on the elliptic curve for this abelian group. In case our X actually comes from the gauge theory, I will not discuss the detailed constructions of gauge theory, but I'm just gonna say that. Well, okay, first of all, our X has some isolated, assume that it has some isolated fixed points for the action of T. Now, in case this X actually comes from the gauge theory as the Higgs branch of some gauge theory, then there are also flat connections. Well, there are also in each isolated vacuum, the gauge field develops a certain profile. In this case, a certain flat connection, Si, which is really a function of this axis. Well, there is also, in addition to axis, I will also use H bar to denote the analogous. The flat connection for this symmetry, which is a variable of the analogous nature, so it's also double periodic. And then in each vacuum, the gauge field develops a certain vacuum expectation value, where A runs from 1 to the number of vacua. And if I denote this, the torus of such flat connections by E, for example, then I can schematically draw the following picture. So here we have the equivariant parameters, so flat connections for flavor symmetry. Here we have this flat connections for gauge symmetry, and each vacuum corresponds to a certain I will represent it as a line, and then we have, if there are several vacua, we have several lines which might intersect. So on top of the generic point here, we have certain number of points, which they just correspond to isolated massive vacuum. But then there are this non-generic points, and they correspond to values of the equivariant parameters where vacuum fail to be isolated. So a certain part of this X sort of gets revived, and we get like copies of CP1 that connect this isolated vacuum.
Why don't the lines all go through the origin? But T includes H bar.
I guess they should go through the origin, yeah.
Is there, I guess otherwise you could use A. And...
Well, in general, if I put all of this to zero, then S will also be zero. So yeah, they all go through the origin.
Yeah, cool.
T includes H also. So it's like this direction is very multidimensional. Yeah. So I guess
you're sort of getting at this, but does the dimension of the Hilbert space jump when you're not fully massive? So for example, if you just use the zero connection.
Yeah. So in general, at such points, your spectrum is not gapped anymore, because
right.
So first of all, this picture should be considered at zero masses, such that I even have the space X to begin with. Of course, at such points, the spectrum, well, it might be gapped, might be not gapped. It depends on whether you get the non-compact pieces that appear. But here, the philosophy is sort of to ignore that and just consider these parts where they are isolated, and then the bundles, the line bundles that I will build soon, I'll just extend them over these points and simply ignore the fact that there's some possibly gapless spectrum. Okay, so now let me focus on just one of this vacuum. Let's say far from the intersection points. And if I look close to that vacuum, then at sufficiently low energies, it looks like I have a theory with a unique gapped vacuum. So if it's a vacuum P, let me call this theory TP. And, well, for people, if people are not familiar with, in physics we say that, so if you have there's a Hamiltonian, which is acting on our Hilbert space, well, it's not really, acting on a Hilbert space on the elliptic curve. And we say that if the spectrum of this Hamiltonian is just zero plus some set, I don't know, let me call it S, such that it lives within the half line with delta large enough, and in principle we at low energies, we can assume that this thing is large. Then we say that it's a gap, so the vacuum is gapped. And at low energies, you just get a theory with a single state, which is the vacuum itself. then sort of effective Hilbert space is just one-dimensional. So it's just this vacuum. Such theories are referred to as invertible theories. They have only one-dimensional space of states. And they're almost trivial, except that you may ask what happens to this vacuum as you change parameters. So here our parameters are these flat connections for the flavor symmetry, or you can also have masses, some coupling constants. And a very natural question in physics is to make these parameters vary slowly in time and in space. And by slowly, like the right word is adiabatically. What that means is that you want, so if this, you have some space of parameters in general, like call it P, you have two points in space of parameters A and B, which are, let's say, at a finite distance from each other, and then you want parameters to change from A to B, but over the infinite amount of time, so like infinitely slowly. And this is called adiabatic approximation. In this limit, usually there's some leading contribution that survives, and everything else vanishes. And if we have such a but we can also consider not just adiabatic approximation, we can just start varying parameters in space and time and ask what happens to this vacuum. And this is governed by the effective action for parameters. In our case, parameters are just background gauge fields, so the corresponding effective action, it just depends on this gauge fields. And in the adiabatic limit, essentially, the only possible term that matters in three dimensions is the Chern-Simons term, which, well, here we have just a billion gauge fields, so I'm going to write it only in that case. So, and here we have some, this background flavor gauge fields, and Kij is a symmetric matrix of integers, or possibly half integers, if we're considering also only limiting ourselves to theories with spinners. So let's see what happens in our case, if we look at such flat connections on the elliptic curve and start changing them slowly with time. Well, here I introduce variables for flat connections. An easy computation, or one can check it as an easy exercise. This gamma evaluates to So here the integral is along the time direction, and as usual, dot is the time derivative. Or if you think about this as an integral in the space of flat connections, so I can write it as an integral over some curve in the space of flat connections of B, where B is the following one form. And it's reasonable to call it Berry connection, because that's the name one uses in physics for such connection that describes what happens with a gapped state when you slowly adiabatically change parameters. In fact, there is a theorem in quantum mechanics called adiabatic theorem that says that in the adiabatic approximation, the system in a gapped state that's isolated by gap, it can be either ground state or it can also be excited state, but isolated from both from the above and from below, it just remains in this state and simply gets parallel transported by this connection.
So that computes a phase in this case. You just have a single vacuum.
Yeah.
And you're computing a phase by which it's the states are multiplied as you're.
Yeah. Okay. Exactly.
So the how are the transsimons terms determined, the k's?
I'll come to that. So there are certain effective terms. So here, these are certain effective transsimons levels associated to an isolated vacuum number p. And
it seems that you would need to turn on masses to make that well defined.
True. So I'll come to that in a moment. Before, in fact, I start talking about transsimons levels, let me also mention that in such complex structure, with such complex coordinates, on this abelian variety of flat connections, this B determines a certain holomorphic structure on the line bundle of spanned by this vacuum. Well, because you can check that dB is a 1,1 form, and then one can compute the general form of a holomorphic section, and from that holomorphic section extract a factor of automorphy. In fact, it was one of the problems in the problem set. And basically, we know factors of automorphy, and then by the known theorems, they basically determine you what's the line bundle on ET associated to a given vacuum with given values of the Chern-Simons terms. Additionally, one can also repeat the same exercise, but for the boundary states. Well, at least one can do that for free theories, but then the philosophy is supposed to hold for more general theories if you have a boundary condition B. It gives you a boundary state B, but a boundary state by itself is highly sort of non-physical. It doesn't belong to the Hilbert space. It's not normalizable, but if you evolve it slightly in Euclidean time, this thing becomes normalizable. It belongs to the Hilbert space, and then for fixed epsilon you can start, and fixed boundary condition, you can start changing parameters and also ask what kind of bundle this forms. And in this case, the corresponding bundle, line bundle on this space of parameters, is determined by the boundary Tuft anomalies, which if you know, you know. I don't have time to introduce that. Just a little. But so normally polynomial associated to this boundary. So in this sense, we have two sources of such line bundles. It's either the bundle of ground states or a bundle associated to the boundary condition. Now, now let's study what kind of Chern-Simons levels we have in our theories. First, so for generic masses, if we have generic real masses turned on, then we have just an isolated set of vacua. Then in the vacuum number P, one can unambiguously compute the corresponding Chern-Simons levels. And most of them originate actually from the BF coupling. So in the classical action, 3D n equals 2 gauge theory action includes a term plus some supersymmetric completion. Where this only picks out the center of your gauge group, so this is another abelian symmetry that's dual to this center, and I'll call the torus of such abelian symmetries A prime, and they're known as topological symmetries in physics. Then the idea is that for each such abelian gauge field, so, because F is just locally, it's just dA, then d, the fact that dF is zero can be written as d star of star F is zero. This means that star F behaves like a conserved current, because this is precisely the conservation equation, and then you get, for each such abelian F, you get additional global symmetry. It doesn't act on the fields, but it acts on your local fields, but it acts on monopole operators, and particles charged under this symmetry are vortices, the same vortices that Andrei was counting this morning.
Chloe, just to point out, that's a very different BF that has appeared.
Oh yeah,
in every other talk in this conference. B is not the same B.
B is not the same B. The name BF is used at all, and that's just because the action is literally BF. So B is just another background gauge field for this new symmetry. Now, in each vacuum, this gauge field F is expressed in a certain sort of effectively replaced by a linear combination of Fs for the flavor symmetries, and this generates you sort of the classical contribution in the Chern-Simons level. So, and this contribution contains sort of the mixed Chern-Simons level for A prime A. So recall that, so A prime is this torus, and A was the torus, maximal torus of GF. And there's also a term for A prime and U1 H bar. Well, in fact, I could just combine them together and say that there is a single mixed Chern-Simons matrix of mixed Chern-Simons levels for such symmetry. So this is classical and depends on vacuum P. Plus there is some additional contribution that arises from the hypermultiplets that you integrate out, the massive one, the massive hypermultiplets, and this gives you additional T cross U1 H bar. This is quantum. This one depends both on P and on chamber, in which the masses take their values. But now we see that the properties of these three theories sort of force this additional symmetry on us, A prime. It has to be included there. The Chern-Simons levels, the Chern-Simons including the effective Chern-Simons includes interactions with, so couplings to this background symmetry. For this reason, we can also introduce another similar variety of flat connections for this topological symmetry, and then view what's sometimes called as extended elliptic cohomology, where we simply multiply this thing by this variety. Oh, and by the way, I think I forgot to say that this collection of lines, some of them might intersect multiple times, that this is the elliptic cohomology variety. Except now, as I explained, we should include both equivariant parameters and this topological symmetries, and then we say that this extended elliptic cohomology variety is just some sub-variety here. That classically describes you the vacua. Now, if we switch off masses, some of them or all of them, such that we get back our x, for generic values of equivariant parameters, the points are still going to be isolated. But and this contribution to the Chern-Simons level is still the same and unambiguous. The question, though, what happens here? And it's a bit ambiguous because the value of the Chern-Simons level, it sort of jumps at when you say go from positive mass to negative mass. So one way to we could just declare this term to be to not be there. Just for example, pick it to be zero. Or another probably more motivated way to do this is to consider configurations where, so here we have massive theory, where we choose vacuum P at infinity, here, so the mass belongs to the chamber C. Here we switch off mass and impose some boundary condition B and measure such overlap to characterize the state that is created by this interface. And in this case, instead of trying to answer what's the effective Chern-Simons level here, we just need analogous levels that are determined by the boundary condition B. And that will unambiguously determine the bundle by the procedure that I told you earlier for each vacuum P. So we have this picture where for each vacuum P, there is a copy of ET cross EA prime over the base, which is ET cross EA prime. And it carries a line bundle, let's say that's LP. But then we have multiple such copies and they intersect. And at the intersection points correspond to non-generic values of the equivariant parameters. And at those values, the Chern-Simons levels corresponding to the two components, they become equal. And so the bundles just agree. And as a result, we can glue them together into one single line bundle over this variety. So now we have two varieties. One is just sort of trivial when we have only isolated, discrete set of points, then this thing is just a disjoint union of ET cross EA prime labeled by vacuum. There's this one, which is constructed sort of as you take this thing and you identify them. If you recall from the previous lecture, there we talked about the walls in the space of real masses. They were root hyperplanes where alpha is a weight associated to the gradient flow connecting to critical points. So this identification simply says that that if I dot this weight with a flat connection and corresponding to sort of one component and the one corresponding to another component, so there are two components. They correspond. There are two components that correspond to critical points P1 and P2. there's a certain flow, and to this there's a that corresponds a weight, and then we say that when alpha dot x h bar is 0 mod z plus tau z, when this happens, that's when we glue them together. And then there is a single line bundle here. And there is a line bundle over the fixed locus. Which is just a collection of line bundles on each individual component. Let me call it LC, because it... whatever. Because the factors of automorphism depend on the chamber where real masses are valued. And now a natural generalization of the question that was asked yesterday about extending equivariant cohomology classes from the fixed locus to the entire space can be asked for sections of these bundles, which are associated to supersymmetric ground states. And that that is what elliptic stable envelopes do, at least for such setting when you consider fixed points over torus, because as you saw this morning, there is also some closely related notion where you extend from the stable locus. But you have sections LC, and they are extended to this. And then again, the claim is that physically, this is realized precisely by this setup. So there is such interface between zero mass and large mass in the chamber C, and it does the job for us. And as we saw in the quantum mechanics construction yesterday, the reason that this is true is basically because everything localizes to these gradient trajectories. And, well, one can actually explicitly write certain expressions in terms of theta functions that represent you sections of such bundles. You write this expression, and then you say that it has the same automorphic factor as any other section of this bundle, and that completely determines you, the bundle. Now let me explain this, the effective way to compute matrix elements of such objects. Namely, if I send mass to infinity, the picture that one might imagine is that, so let's say that this is our x, here are the isolated vacua, and close to each vacuum there's a tower of light states. And here I turned on real masses from the chamber C. And actually, I'm sending them to infinity inside the chamber C. In this limit, our theory the entire gauge theory approximately decomposes as a direct sum of theories. First of all, we start with our theory, then we turn on masses in the chamber C. We get certain low energy description that contains only this light modes. Which are literally the part of the Hilbert space that doesn't go away to infinity as you send masses to infinity. So their energy remains finite. And this effective description, effective theory, breaks into sectors labeled by these fixed points. And so if we choose a vacuum P at infinity, what we really end up with is an interface between the full theory at zero mass here and this sector here. This interface for each chamber, as it turns out, can be described canonically. You just keep all the fields that remain light in the vacuum P. For them, this interface is transparent. Fields that that receive large positive mass, it depends on how you orient things, in which direction the time runs, but the way I drew it, if the Euclidean time goes to the right, then fields that receive positive mass, they are given Neumann boundary conditions here. And so positive then Neumann boundary conditions, and if mass is negative, they're given Dirichlet boundary conditions. And this just determines you a consistent interface between these two theories. And you might start computing the matrix elements of such interface, which means that, so here we are on this, there's a torus. So this is our interface. We impose boundary conditions. Get this sort of interval reduction compute, and the answer takes the form of just elliptic genus of such effective 2D theory that you get by sandwiching this interface between two boundary conditions. In practice, the simplest way to do this is to impose certain enriched Dirich-Neumann boundary conditions here, corresponding to vacuum P, and Dirichlet boundary conditions here. But because the masses are zero on this site, this Dirichlet boundary condition involves a choice, because there's no natural choice. Such boundary conditions, they really, for each hypermultiplet, which is a pair of chiral multiplets, you choose which one to give Dirichlet, which one to give Neumann boundary conditions. And here it's a choice, which is determined by a choice of polarization called L. On X, for example, or you can choose polarization on the original space of linear hypermultiplets. And up to normalization, this coincides with the expressions for stable envelopes that Andrei confused with Mina in their paper. Now, But the main idea really is that you choose boundary condition, it gives you a certain state, which for each fixed value of flat connection, so it's just cohomologous to the supersymmetric ground state. So up to normalization, such interval partition functions, they simply compute you the matrix elements of this interface between supersymmetric ground states. But then there are these additional choices that matter if you start fibering this thing over the space of parameters. Now I will talk about the applications of this. So,
sorry, can I say again, where does the A prime come from?
A prime.
Yes.
How should I explain this to a mathematician? Well, then, for each abelian factor in the gauge group, you have here, there's a gauge field. So it's just a U1 gauge field, right? So that's part of the gauge group. But then you can define such thing and observe that it just trivially obeys equation D star J equals zero. In physics, this is the conservation law. It means that J is a conserved current. It corresponds to some symmetry. So for each abelian factor in the gauge group, there's additional U1 symmetry. If you wish, that's in this morning in Andrei's lecture, there was a little variable little z, which was counting the quasi-maps, so the degree of quasi-maps. So that degree is the charge under this additional symmetry.
You may have said this already, Kolya. Sure, Andrei did, but in terms of the variety for each Kähler parameter, each direction you can resolve in, this three-dimensional theory happens to have another U1 global symmetry. That's the connection for it.
Yeah.
It's a connection.
Can I ask about that? I mean, sort of mathematicians knew, I mean, I don't know the exact, I mean, Kalyadin was writing all these papers back in the early 2000s about symplectic resolutions and kind of finding out, in some sense, this fact that that there were these kind of, you know, that you had these symmetry actions and you had these directions you could resolve in, and they were both. My question is like, is trying to understand things from this physical perspective, could I like relearn any of the things that Kalyadin learned about symplectic resolutions back in the day?
Probably. I'm not that familiar with his work, so I cannot answer that. Definitely, but yeah. Yeah, I can try to say.
So one. It's not so clear how many symplectic resolutions are there. So the ones which come from some kind of JIT reductions, they're everything's very visible for them. For Kalyadin, the main struggle was to prove something for things which aren't symplectic reductions. And so, yeah, maybe in the end it will turn out that in fact his work was maybe not needed, or maybe will be part of the classification. But right now there is a big, I mean, in terms of difficulty, there is a big, big gap between things which we understand concretely, like Nakajima varieties, in some abstract symplectic resolutions about which we know what's in Kaledin's and Namikawa's papers, and then by some very complex, much, much more complex argument.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Thank you. And now let me briefly talk about the two applications. So first, in addition to such settings, one might consider the objects that some people here really like, namely the half index. It admits a deformation. Physically, it's computed by a certain path integral on with a certain action on the, like, there are some background fields, but it admits a deformation where you can stretch it. Such that one of the preserved supercharges behaves in the following way, that in this region, it behaves as a supercharge for the what's known as 3D n equals 2 A twist. In that twist, if you just consider Segal partition function for such twist, so if you do this like this, and pick vacuum P at infinity, what you get is this, the object which goes under many names, vortex partition function, vertex function, holomorphic block, some people even call it homological block, but basically everyone's trying to invent their own name. But that's basically this thing in the quantum K-theory class that Andrei was explaining this morning. Now, if you look at it far away at infinity, you see that the two circles, this circle and this additional circle, that is like time, and so you get elliptic curve. So it has to... as was already mentioned earlier this morning, it has something to do with elliptic classes as well, not just with the K-theory. So one can start acting with such interfaces here from infinity on this partition function and see what happens. For that, it's useful to consider slightly different background, not just the A-twisted background, but take this physical half index and stretch it, and one gets this background where the conserved the supercharge close to the boundary is our Q, which squares to the anti-holomorphic derivative, and the one that's preserved here, and here close to the tip, it becomes QA, the A twisted one. And then in this background, you can basically just consider the same interfaces, but acting on this partition function from infinity. And if we combine such interfaces, by the way, they're often called Janus interfaces whenever you have some parameters that change their values. It's called Janus interfaces. We can consider both Janus interfaces, for example, for mass that, let's say, changes mass from 0 to m in chamber C, and for Fi parameters that changes the Fi parameters from some value to zero. And in this way, you sort of engineer an interface which moves you between different phases of the theory, say between Higgs and Coulomb phase. And as a result, you transform your vortex partition function between the Higgs phase, where it computes quasi-maps into the Higgs branch, and the Coulomb phase, where it computes something like quasi-maps into the Coulomb branch, but then you can also apply mirror symmetry, and you'll get quasi-maps into the Higgs branch of the mirror theory. And it becomes apparent that they're related by the action of these interfaces, which are proportional to stable envelopes. If one works out normalization carefully, then it turns out that what acts there is this thing that Andrei and Mina call pole subtraction matrix, which transforms this vertex function between Higgs and Coulomb branches. Right, and here we can also, of course, consider various generalizations. Like, we could start adding line operators here, which would be labeled by K-theory classes of X, consider different boundary conditions here at infinity that would be labeled, or at the boundary of the hemisphere that would be labeled by elliptic cohomology classes, and in this way you get these maps that were described this morning. I sort of apologize that today's lecture is way less pedagogical than yesterday's, so probably, I don't know, how many people feel like they're lost? Okay. Maybe half people are honest. And in the remaining time, I will talk about another application to the R matrices. Now here we were constructing interfaces between zero mass and mass within the chamber, but we can run the same machinery and obtain an interface between mass in chamber one and mass in chamber two. Mathematically, this is gonna be something like stable envelope for chamber one, composed with inverse of the stable envelope for chamber two. And let's call it R, C1, C2. So this is the chamber R matrix. And the point is that it can be used to construct and sort of explain various quantum algebras which appear in the context of the Bethe-Gage correspondence, namely for if we start with say gauge theory, there's a certain way in which you can associate to a family of gauge theories. You can associate an integrable model, which is a representation of a Youngian or a loop algebra or elliptic version thereof. Okay, so we have this object which sends the space of vacuum at mass in chamber C1 to the space of vacuum mass in chamber C2. If we suppose that we have our theory and we have chosen some subgroup in the flavor symmetry group, and M is the corresponding real mass, then in this case the interface we would naturally consider is going from, say, positive mass to negative mass. If we turn on this mass and make it very large, the theory will also decompose into sectors. Let's say there are two sectors. Then the vacuum, if I denote vacuum of each of these sectors, but the vector space of vacuum by Vi, then the corresponding R matrix that corresponds to the interface changing the sign of mass, it's just gonna map from the space of vacuum here, which is the tensor product here. So at the interface where the mass changes sign, they sort of start talking to each other and we get a non-trivial map. The simplest example would be in supersymmetric quantum mechanics, where X is the T star of CP1. So there is only one mass. This is the T star of CP1. It has two isolated fixed points, say 1 and 2. And the corresponding R matrix is just, so by the way, I should note that it depends on equivariant parameters, which in this context are called spectral parameters, because that's the name in the integrable literature. So covariant parameters X, then there's also this H bar, which it was also one of the equivariant parameters, but on the integrable side, it becomes this quantization deformation. And in the elliptic case, they also depend on Z, which I think is called dynamical parameter, right? In the integrable science. In the simplest quantum mechanics case, this will be just this, where P, so here we have identity matrix, and P is a permutation matrix. So, like, so we see that changing the sign of mass sort of mixes these two vacua. By considering more interesting or gauge theories, one can construct more interesting examples. In particular, let me show you how to get the XXX or XXZ or XYZ spin chains. So that's like some of the simplest spin chains that are solved by Beth and Ansatz. For that purpose, as a theory T, I'm going to consider not a single theory, but a family of quantum field theories. A family will be labeled by L, which is a positive integer. Which will be the number of spins in your spin chain. And here I will just encode the theory by its n equals 4 quiver. So we have L fundamental hypermultiplets with a gauge group UN. So it means that the gauge group is UN. And there are L fundamentals. And I take all possible values of them from 0 to L. So there's such a family of quantum field theories. Then, well, let me write it like this, T of L. Then I can do the following. Consider a family of L1 plus L2. And pick a U1 subgroup of the flavor group symmetry that's only acting on the L2 of the hypermultiplets. So I sort of separate hypermultiplets into two groups. And this is, by the way, the construction I'm describing is a reformulation of something from Malik Okunkov paper, quantum groups and quantum cohomology. So if I pick this U1, then consider the corresponding real mass M, then this light theory that I get as I send mass m to infinity, the effective theory of light degrees of freedom. If one thinks for a moment, you'll see that it's just T of L1 tensor T of L2. So what does it mean? Each of these T's is a direct sum, so it's like a family of quantum field theories. Then you take tensor product, you open brackets, and you get a direct sum of tensor products. So direct sum, it means it's just a sectors which do not talk to each other. Tensor product, it means that you put two theories on top of each other. So it's like they simply do not interact. But that's different from direct sum, because when you take direct sum of quantum field theories, the corresponding Hilbert spaces also are added. Whereas when you take tensor product of quantum field theories, they are tensor multiplied. And then if I consider the R matrix for such mass, it's simply going to send me from the space of, well, you can already guess what it will give me. Or V of L is the space of the supersymmetric ground states of the family. As a result of this construction, so notice that the dimension of this V of L is 2 to the L. So V of L is identified with a Hilbert space of the spin chain that has L spins. So just like it. There are L spins. And in the cohomological case, what you obtain is the XXX spin chain. you could pictorially represent this R matrix as something like this, where you have L1 lines here, L2 lines here. Each carries a spectral parameter, which is associated to this X. And you get something at the output. Now, really, the most standard terminology is to call this the R matrix, and call this, where you have, say, L1 equals 1, and L2 equal, well, just L2, call this the L operator, whatever, that's the... Then one can easily show, using the properties of this interface, is that this operator, which has, so in our case, you can write it in the following form. It's an operator with two indices, where A and B take only two values, 1 and 2, which corresponds to N having two values for when L equals to 1, 0 and 1. And it acts in this direction between C to the power 2 to the L 2. And as I said, using properties of interfaces, one can show that they obey the so-called RLL relations, which are certain quadratic relations, which basically mean that in this case, the data of such operators give you the representation of the Yangian on this space, where the generators are realized by such interfaces. The mass changes sign, and we consider this whole family of theories simultaneously. Note that some interfaces will be changing the rank of your gauge group, for example, which are like the raising and lowering operators in the Yangian. And that is closely related to constructions of Nakajima and Varanolo, who constructed actions of Yangian and in the cohomological case, and action of the quantum loop algebra in the K-theoretic case on the equivariant K-theory of Nakajima Kuiwa varieties. But they sort of get it in the different basis, in the different presentation of the Yangian, because there are like three known presentations. Here we get the RTT presentation in the natural way. Much bigger than what?
If for general quiver, this one will be much bigger algebra than what they construct.
Okay. I guess that's great. Well, that's, I think I've also run out of material that I was planning to present. And I should perhaps finish by saying that these theories, they also admit a realization there by in string theory by certain brain realization that Lev liked very much. And then those brain realizations by the sequence of string dualities can be transformed in the setup, which produces the same integrable models within the four-dimensional term Simons. So these two approaches are actually related by the string dualities. That's it.
Okay, thanks for the applications.
So those string dualities that you were just talking about, are they in your paper or?
Not yet. That will be in part three.
Can you just say a little bit more?
Well, the details, okay, I can say just roughly. Don't ask me for details like...
I mean, I only understand roughly, so...
Well, last time I was attempting to talk about it, people were asking some about some annoying details, like why supersymmetry is not broken in this brain configuration. But roughly, the setup is that you have... our elliptic curve cross time cross another R, which I'll call Rm, cross R2, just like with omega deformation, and then there is some ALE space, so say resolution of ADE singularity. And then we have D4 brains, which are wrapping these three directions and compact cycles here. Then we have, so this will be called color D4 brains. Then there are flavor D4 brains. And they are wrapping non-compact cycles here. Our flat connections mean that as we go around the cycles of the torus, we rotate this space, and we also rotate cycles in ADE. Now, the profile of masses means that in this plane, RT and RM, so you have color brains, which are sort of sitting at RM equals zero, and then you have flavor brains, where the position in Rm determines the value of the corresponding mass. When you have such interface where mass changes from minus infinity to plus infinity, it's like you consider profile, and in the limit it becomes sort of vertical. And then you can have several such brains that become vertical. Well, there's another setup which I sort of forgot, where I want to consider actually the six brains, flavor brains, which will also wrap this direction. And then I would be looking at the theory that lives on this brain, on these brains. I guess I passed to this. Sorry, I forgot how I passed to this. There must be some sequence of dualities. But the point is that. Then you do. What do you do? Oh no, maybe it's fine.
We could also just discuss afterwards.
Yeah, we could discuss it. The point is that I want to get six-dimensional theory with this gauge group, which then after reduction on R2H becomes, it has a supersymmetric sector, which is the 4D transdiamonds, and this is your grid of line operators.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning that. It was going to ask the same thing. Any other questions? In a talk in the morning, when we discuss quasi maps, we are considering the maps from P1 to X. In the first application we discuss here, it seems our setting is closer to the map of from elliptic curve to X. So I'm wondering how does the quasi maps from P1 shows up?
No, in the first application, it's actually maps from the disk to X, where the boundary of the disk is mapped to say one point. So it's basically the same as a sphere with a mark point, where a mark point goes to a given point in your target. Because I was in the first application, I was looking at a cigar or a hemisphere times a circle. And what it really means is that first you should open the circle and replace it by a line, and then you consider states in such in the Hilbert space associated to the disk, and then you closing the line into a circle means the corresponding partition function is counting these states. So then you ask what kind of states you're counting, and for that you look at the BPS equations in this background, and they turn out to be the vortex equations. So you're really counting particles, which are point like these vortices on the disk, and they extend in the time direction. It's like the world line of a particle.
I guess depending on which direction you choose to think of as time, this either looks like a torus times horizontal time, or like a disk times the unwrapped S1 time.
Absolutely, yeah.
The change of perspective that relates to. Any other questions? Online? Hey, let's all thank Kali again.